Welcome to the Security Weekly News Wrap-Up Show for the week of June 20, 2021. Orgy advice from the New York City Health Department, Windows 11, John McAfee, Dell UEFI, Zixel, or however you say that, dark radiation, and more, along with all the show wrap-ups on this edition of the Security Weekly News Wrap-Up Show.
This is Security Weekly, for security professionals, by security professionals.
We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
It's the show that keeps you up to date on the latest security news twice a week, your trusted source for accurate security information and expert analysis. It's time for Security Weekly News. For teams looking to inject some security into the DevOps lifecycle, the Uptick Security Analytics platform offers complete security observability for your cloud workloads, including hosts, VMs, containers, and micro VMs. Uptick analyzes builds in development and at runtime for real-time detection of misconfigurations, vulnerabilities, and malicious behavior. Security Weekly listeners can sign up for a free 2-week trial by visiting securityweekly.com/Uptick. With the skills gap increasing, it's more important than ever to train your staff effectively and efficiently. Offensive Security provides training for your organization designed by the same minds behind Kali Linux. Here are two recent offerings from OFSEC. OFSEC Academy gives you the chance to earn industry-leading OSCP certification with dedicated one-on-one mentoring. You can also try Proving Grounds Enterprise, created exclusively by Offensive Security's InfoSec experts for highly realistic simulated networks. Visit securityweekly.com/OFSEC to learn more.
Hi, I'm Doug White from Roger Williams University. I am your host on the Security Weekly News Wrap-Up Show. Let's wrap up all the show topics for the week. On Application Security Weekly number 155, John and Mike had Nuno Lerero and Tiago Mendo, the co-founder and CEO of Probly. I remember how to say that. Probly. Nuno is a CEO and Tiago is a CTO and co-founder of Probly. Nuno and Tiago were on to talk about dynamic application security testing scanners. So if you've heard people say DAST, that's what it stands for. And those are tools that are used to examine, the application security of stuff that you're working on. They were talking about challenges in using these DAST scanners. And things like modern applications, the time it takes to scan, like how long it takes to run partial scans, large scale scans, stuff like that. So basically, what are people trying to find in DAST scanners? On Business Security Weekly number 221, Jason, Adrian, and Matt had Ben Higgins and Ted Driggs, the distinguished software engineer and the head of product at ExtraHop, on the show. They were talking about the SBOM, another acronym, which is, of course, the Software Bill of Materials. And so that was part of U.S. President Joe Biden's executive order and how that that was issued in response to SolarWinds and Colonial Pipeline and so forth. But SBOM is primarily focused on supply chain attack. And they were talking about how transparency in these things can actually be used to your advantage. So an interesting segment. In the second segment, news articles included, what is the hidden cost of maintaining legacy systems? I would like to know. 10 leadership habits of highly effective leaders, 5 key ingredients to finding satisfaction and fulfillment in your work, and other stories. On Enterprise Security Weekly 232, Adrian and Paul and Tyler Shields brought on Donnie Brass, the product management lead at Cisco. Donnie was going to talk about cloud apps and their use by bad actors. In particular, the risk of how this is starting to target work from home and how none of that's going to go away as the pandemic starts to fade into the background. Because last year, as you recall, at this time, we were doing a lot of stories about how people were using the cloud to attack stuff in the cloud, how people were attacking all these work from home types that have been set up hurriedly. None of that's going away. A lot of companies are planning to not get rid of this stuff in the future. They've invested heavily in this hybrid work environment. And found out that pretty much it works okay, at least the places that I work. In the second segment, Brendan McCarrig, the Senior Director of Product Marketing at Fastly, was on to talk about how security is a shared responsibility, but security teams actually have to be involved in the app development cycle. Sound familiar? With an understanding of the apps and the APIs that are being used, or it just gets ugly. The focus of the segment was on real-time visibility instead of what we usually see, which is, you know, maybe a meeting at the beginning of a process and then maybe a meeting in the middle of the process and a meeting at the end of the process where they go, okay, it's secure, right? And, you know, code is very complex anymore. It was always complex, but it's particularly complex now. And if you don't understand the code, you don't understand the APIs, stuff's just going to sneak in there and you're going to have problems. And in the third segment, the news. On Security Compliance Weekly 7-7, Jeff, Josh, and Scott, while they didn't have their usual large number of hosts, we're talking with Casey Marks, the Chief Product Officer and Vice President at ISC Squared, our old friend. Casey was talking about cybersecurity certification and what it really means. This is a common debate and a common question. I get asked this question, you know, probably at least every other week. Somebody contacts me and asks about certification versus education versus just going to work. You see Quora questions and stuff all the time. You know, I mean, it is a common question and it is a good debate. And I don't know a concise answer to it. But, you know, what is the purpose of certification? Is it just proof of knowledge and skill, or is it a training tool, or just what is it? And I've seen it done all those ways. In the second segment, of course, they continue talking about that. On Security Weekly News number 129, an outstanding job was done by the amazing Aaron Leyland, who can charm the gold lamé shorts off of any festival attendee, all while securing your setup. Aaron was filling in for me, who was called into something I thought we had abandoned forever, in-person summer orientation for freshmen. And if you ever want to get that itchy feeling about being around large, crowded rooms full of people who are wearing masks and sneezing, well, that's what freshman orientation is all about. Smells like teen spirit. Anyway, Aaron did a great job, and he's going to fill in again next week when I have to do another of those wonderful, exciting events, which just happened to fall on Tuesdays this year for some strange reason, and also Fridays, which is why I'm in this weird set. Jason Wood's secret fears were revealed, and Jason talked about how a simple countermeasure could have prevented the whole SolarWinds thing. Check it out and give Aaron a shout out on one of the many environments where we are carried. Thank you, Aaron. On Paul's Security Weekly number 700 last night, Paul has returned. And first up was Jim O'Gorman, the Chief Content and Strategy Officer at Offensive Security. Jim was talking about his career progression and what does it take to be successful in InfoSec. Another very common question that I get asked a lot. A lot of talk about jobs and roles and what do they mean and this kind of stuff. You know, so it's definitely worth checking that out if you missed it last night. In the second segment, my friend and oft-times co-author Tom Lenardo, who is famous slash infamous, I don't know. There's a famous paper called the Lenardo PI paper that was published a long time ago in the forensics world and is today called the Lenardo paper. And he's an attorney, and he was on to talk about the CFAA and the Van Buren opinion. The Van Buren opinion was, of course, about a law enforcement officer who was being paid money by third parties to investigate license plates in the police database. And that case went all the way to the Supreme Court, and he was prosecuted under the CFAA, and there was a big opinion. So glad to finally get to see Tom on Pulse Security Weekly. And in the third segment, the news. My favorite threat of the week is going to be the UEFI threats. I saw that Dell story this week. A lot of people had that story talking about it was an Eclipsium report that basically there was a bug in this pre-installed BIOS updater that Dell puts on all of, well, not the same one, but Dell has something of this nature on almost all their equipment. And there were actually four different bugs in those systems that would allow, essentially, according to this article, for the takeover of 30 million endpoints worldwide. You know, 30 million. That's 129 different models of Dell equipment that has this pre-installed BIOS updater on it. You know, and so basically, just for some of us who are not always maybe seen some of this stuff in a while. This is a BIOS updater. So the basic input-output system for the computer is a part of the firmware. So this is something that's installed on the chipset that comes with the motherboard. And I actually kind of started calling it floppyware because it's not really firm any longer. Settle down. But, you know, since you could start flashing it, it's not like the old ROM days where you needed, like the first time I ever dealt with a BIOS was on a Tandy 1000 and you actually had to take the, you had to desolder the chips and solder, new chips on to change things. Once they started flashing these things, initially, you know, they burned the flash image to a floppy disk, and then you booted the machine from the floppy drive, because I don't know if you've ever noticed in your BIOS, you can set it so that it boots from, you know, CDs or floppies or whatever. And that BIOS then copied over. And it was a real dangerous thing to do because the power failed or the floppy drive failed or the cable failed or you accidentally kicked the plug out or your cat stepped on the off switch. It would literally brick everything. Over time, they moved on and they started building this stuff with an onboard TCP/IP stack in this what is called UEFI today. And that basically meant that the BIOS could use a networkable stack that would let it connect to the internet and then flash itself, which sounds awesome. And like a lot of things, it's very convenient. And you know, we continue to move in that direction. This is typically only able to be done when the system is booting. So you can't, it's not something that typically can be done while the machine is running, although it wouldn't shock me to see if they're trying to move in that direction. But anyway, so in this particular case with the Dell system, the secure boot process is the problem. And secure boot is a tool that is used to basically make sure that what is running and what is being loaded is essentially what is supposed to be run and loaded. So originally secure boot, I think, and so I'm sort of speculating, came out of the idea that people would try to install things on their system that were not compatible with that system. And again, you end up with a bricked system. So people started using stuff like secure boot in order to protect against that. But then secure boot became a thing about, you know, how do you ensure that things are not being used inappropriately? Now, it also is used by manufacturers to try to make sure that you don't install stuff that they don't want you to install or that you didn't pay for. So it kind of like a lock on an iPhone or something like that. But anyway, Eclipsium found four problems in this Dell bootloader secure boot system, which would allow you to circumvent the secure boot. And if you could circumvent the secure boot, you could circumvent the operating system and all the security controls, because this stuff's running below the level of the operating system. You know, so your login has not been reviewed lately. The CVE average on it was 8.3, so it's not really the end of the world, but it does reintroduce all these ideas we saw last year when there were some UEFI attacks, you know, that were going on. And, you know, one of the things I would equate that to is in the old forensics days, you know, early on, we used to use this trick a lot. Mount a volume, like a Windows volume, in Linux. So that NTFS volume, you mount it in Linux, and guess what? You could look at the drive. You didn't have to have a password. You didn't have to have anything. You could see what was there. And once you mounted that C drive up, if you knew what was going on, and of course, that's not that hard to figure out, Windows used to write passwords and usernames, just like Unix, to the locations on the hard drive in plain text. So you could actually just look at the file with Linux, see what the username and passwords were, and then you could log in and boom, you know, if so somebody lost their password. I used to see those posts all the time, like, what if I lost my password to this Windows server that is running at my work? Anyway, the UEFI and other attacks like this are, again, a sort of low-level circumvention of all these kind of security controls, which would let you get into the system without a privilege level, or typically as root, or at least root in that system. And all of a sudden, all those pesky group policy objects, domains, logins, you know, all that good stuff, it's not really there. And it's not quite as simple as that, but you get the idea. So the Dell issue is all that and more, in the sense that when you try to use the UEFI interface to connect to the Dell server, Basically, what it does is there's a TLS issue, and all this in the article I did attach, you can read about it if you want all those details. But basically, the UEFI system will accept any valid wildcard cert. So it doesn't validate that it actually is connecting to a Dell server. It could connect anybody. So essentially, you could put a server up in an environment where people are doing these updates, and you could deliver whatever you wanted to, including all kinds of cooked versions of operating systems or the firmware. And most of this was targeting firmware. But if you did that, if you could push something into the firmware, you could have it download, you know, who knows what. Anyway, this is always to me been a bad idea, you know, to mess with the firmware in any way. And if you do screw it up, it's going to basically brick it. And so, you know, this kind of hacking stuff is probably going to be pretty tricky to put together. But I think this lab version that they did in this experiment, Eclipsium, is probably quite a bit easier to implement than a real world version would be. But the reason I put this in the op-ed was it starts to drive this thing, which I call the mesh event. And the question is, at some point, we are going to be doing this stuff in the background of a myriad of devices that will surround us all the time, maybe on the fly. So maybe even while they're running, they'll be able to like do almost like a buffered boot up. And then, you know, like, so it never interrupts. So one thing's going in the background, the other thing's going on, and then they just sort of switch places or something like that. And I mean, I know I start to sound like William Gibson or something. I guess I'm flattering myself, but William Gibson did predict the internet and all. But I mean, imagine if you have a mesh like that around you that has all your micro drones, your implants, your visual supplements, so your failing eyes can continue to see, your pacemaker, your kidney enhancement, your hearing adapter. Not that I need all those things, but, you know, not to mention your universal translator and your personal environment controls. I mean, all those things are going to need updating, and they're all going to have some kind of BIOS of some sort that manages that process and some sort of operating system. And, you know, they're going to have some kind of back end that will let you update them, because we've seen over and over again that people release things that have problems. So even all this BIOS stuff is moving to that kind of control. And my laptop continually is always telling me it wants to update, and it does update the BIOS that way, because it phones home, gets a piece of information from the company that manufactured it that says you need to update the firmware, and then it pops up a message. It can't at the moment update the firmware without my intervention, but it does get messages about that. So I think these kind of low-level attacks are going to get worse. You know, I mean, the electrical engineers that built the chips that put the firmware on there, they probably didn't want to involve the security team any more than the app dev people do. And they just go ahead with whatever works. And, you know, somewhere in the process, they have the scheduled bubble that says meeting with security team, and they call them in and go, everything's good, right? But it is scary. And I do think the UEFI stuff is harder to do from a hacking perspective. But, you know, when the low hanging fruit's gone, you have to climb up into the tree if you want to keep eating. So guess what? People will. And, you know, if you implement your personal micro drone swarm, well, you know, kids bullied at school, keep them safe with the My Drone Friend and Foe micro drone system. Little Dakota will be protected by as many as 1,000 micro drones, each armed with a thermo-tipped lance rifle. Those bullies won't stand a chance when they're taken down by an angry swarm of micro bees with a combined killing power of a Hellfire missile. Now available for only $19.99 per month with a one-time down payment of €500. My Drone cannot protect you from the My Bully system or other anti-drone bullying system, which use the Little Devil anti-drone UEFI microwave attack platform. In all cases, it is advisable to retain private security support. And in the news. If you didn't hear this, and I bet you have, John McAfee, who created, you know, McAfee, probably one of the first antivirus platforms that everybody saw, went from, you know, being a programmer to being, you know, some kind of like billionaire to being, you know, sort of a crazy billionaire to maybe possibly an evil billionaire to being broke to being a billionaire again, and on and on and on. But John McAfee was found dead in jail in Barcelona, Spain on Wednesday. Now, as you know, John's been a bit out there for a while. And I mean, some people idolize him because he was sort of this, you know, hacker personified kind of thing. Pictures with him with, you know, machine guns on yachts and stuff like that. Very, you know, Scarface kind of thing going on. Say hello to my little friend. Can you? I can't believe Al Pacino did that part. Boy, things changed. But anyway, if you really want to get offended, watch that movie. But and you know, John been a bit out there, and at least that's how he was portrayed. So you know, I mean, we all know that sometimes people are portrayed in different ways, and sometimes it's them being sure they're portrayed that way. But anyway, McAfee was 75 years old, and he was awaiting extradition to the United States, and the extradition had just been it was at the final state of approval, and he's been there for several years. So he tried to get on a plane to Turkey or something. He was in Spain. They arrested him at the airport. I think that was back in 2019. And he's been sitting in jail ever since. He sends out lots of tweets and Instagrams and all kinds of stuff, even though he's in jail. But, you know, whatever. Anyway, he's charged in the U.S. with evading taxes related to cryptocurrency. And he's been basically, he did that for about 4 years that they've got records of. He's also got a whole pile of other charges of like commodities fraud, securities fraud, wire fraud, money laundering, and, you know, all kinds of stuff. Apparently some of this was based on what's called a pump and dump scheme, which is where you get a celebrity to go out and rave about something, and then you basically have already bought it. The celebrity raves about it, and everybody goes, "Oh wow, that's got to be great!" And then you sell yours, and then everybody gets left holding the bag. You know, not like Dogecoin or anything like that at all. But anyway, he was pitching this to investors, even though he was actually being paid to pitch it to investors. He's been in the news a lot since about 2009. When he claimed that he was wiped out financially by the global financial crisis. But then in 2012, he was a suspect in a murder in Belize, and he fled to Guatemala, which apparently was illegal. There was some period of time he was on a yacht. He, you know, there's all kinds of crazy stuff. I mean, I spent a lot of time on this, but, you know, McAfee's pretty interesting story. Anyway, apparently he hanged himself in his cell, which was quite interesting. And it was preceded by a very cryptic post to Instagram of just one letter Q. And I'm not even going there. But, anyway, in 2020, the sort of other interesting parts of this, and I'm not a huge conspiracy person because I find it hard to believe that you could ever keep the lid on any of this kind of stuff for a long time, but maybe I'm naive. In 2020, McAfee tweeted, know that if I hang myself a la Epstein, referring to Jeffrey Epstein, who hanged himself in New York, who was involved in all this child sex trafficking stuff with a bunch of big shots. Know that if I hang myself a la Epstein, it will be no fault of mine. He also had a tattoo, and he posted pictures of this on Twitter that said $whacked, which I presume means swacked or dollar whacked. I don't know what it means. It's these kids today and their slang. But he tweeted that out with the message, if I suicide myself, I didn't. So it's hard to tell what was going on with Mr. McAfee as to what was true, what was false, what was swagger, what was his PR people, what was the media. The guy was just, whew. Yeah. Anyway, along with the UEFI stuff earlier, Zixel issued a warning about their USG. Sorry, I had to take a breath there. Their USG Zywall, USG Flex, ATP, and VPN series devices, which are running ZLD firmware. The company sent out a letter which said that a sophisticated threat actor was attempting to access the devices via the WAN, which I presume they mean internet, and that if they were able to access the device, they were attempting to bypass authentication to establish SSL VPN channels, which would allow them to connect your network, I guess. Apparently, a series of accounts are in the firmware, which can be used to manipulate the device configuration. I wanted to mention this one. If you do have any of these devices, you want to read all the grim details. It is in the article. They talk about all the accounts and their names and so forth. Back in January, Zixel had a hard-coded password issue that was patched. But so far on this one, their only advice was, quote, maintain proper security policy for remote access, which is always good advice. You bet. Dark Radiation, cool name. is a new strain of ransomware that targets Linux and Docker cloud containers and is implemented in Bash. So this is an interesting one. The targets are primarily CentOS and Debian distros. There was no evidence of, in this, at least they reported, of this being used in the wild, but the findings were from a collection of tools that was stored on an IP address, 185.141.25.168. Oh, that's in the article. And it was in a directory called API Attack. And so this was reported by a Twitter user in May. The ransomware is a framework, and it's got multiple, they actually have the source code because they got it off this server, apparently. The ransomware is a framework with multiple stages. It's got a command and control server. It's got hard-coded API keys that are used for the encryption in AES. And it appears to be something that's under development. It first checks to see if it's root. So, you know, use sudo, unless you're lazy, like some of us. And if you are root, then it installs wget, curl, OpenSSL libraries, usual stuff, grabs all the user information that it can, and exfiltrates all that using Telegram. So that's an encrypted platform for, like social media exchange. It can then take other actions if these tools and privileges are not available. So there was other approaches that it had built into it as well. Finally, it gets the entire user list, changes all the passwords on the system to mega password, just like one word, mega password, and deletes all shell users. So that would leave like root and other accounts still there. A new user with the name Ferrum, is created before it starts its encryption process. And it also is wormable. So it's not clear how they intend to deliver it or who's going to deliver it or when they're going to deliver it, but it's probably in the usual ways. So, you know, watch out. So Microsoft confirmed that Windows 11 is a thing this week, officially. We talked about this last week. And they listed a lot of items, including that Windows Explorer will now be disabled, which I presume it is still installed. They've done this with other stuff in the past. But they replaced it with Edge. And so the three people that are still using Windows Explorer, will be unhappy. And, you know, there's not that many users of that anyway. But you know, hey, now you'll have Edge on everything, if you want it. I primarily use it to install other browsers, but anyway, other features that are going away will be, the movable taskbar. So some people put the taskbar up at the top of the screen. I had a friend who was really into that. And it will only be allowed at the bottom of the screen. And they also announced they're going to remove live tiles, named groups, and folders of apps. So all that stuff seems to be gone. That was all associated with live tiles. Tablet mode, timeline, and wallet, also have bitten the wax tadpole along with, here's a whole list, 3D viewer, Paint 3D, OneNote, and Skype. Thank you. Please get rid of Skype. But those will still be available if you do want them. So you can go and download them and install them. So they say. The list of things I don't use in Windows 10 goes on and on and on. So I hate to be a hater, you know, OneNote, but I never really knew you. Anyway, looks like they're finally getting rid of a lot of mandatory installs that I have never seen anyone use, but I know you love OneNote, but apparently not many other people do. Anyway, every time they do this, it's an adventure, and they've definitely had more hits. They've had, you know, I don't know if they've had more hits and misses or not, but for whatever reason, we're still running Windows. You will apparently be able to run Android apps on the desktop, which could mean Microsoft's going to be Android interesting. As long as we're talking about it, though, some other things they're planning to add. The start menu is going to be centered at the bottom and will have calculator, Edge, and settings by default. Probably be hard to get rid of Edge off there. It always is. Anyway, according to this article, it's basically a Windows 10X shell for Windows 10. With some new visual features. The report says they now have a Windows camera settings section so you can customize your cameras without using third-party software. That would be nice, if it works. A lot of times it seems like their stuff is like great new camera features, but then it doesn't work with any camera at all except the most expensive ones. I know that's the way the face identity stuff was. I finally bought a camera so I could try it out. A new clipboard is coming. The virtual desktop looked a lot more Mac-like, to me in the pictures. I didn't see a lot of actual features, in this. It was more cosmetic. They did say they were going to provide DNS over HTTPS, which is called DOE. DOE. has been added to the network operation, a new disk management tool, because, man, is that thing old. That thing's been the same since, like, Windows XP, I think. And they're supposedly going to add better GPU control, if you could actually get a GPU these days, and apparently a new sound option. Still, it really had a lot more cosmetic sound, so like the Windows 8 kind of thing, than what it sounded like any real change. So I didn't see anything about new security, new protocols, or anything like that, so it may just be Windows 10X shell, you know. Google's rolling out security updates for Google Drive on September 13th, which is allegedly to make file sharing more secure. The story, well, this will likely is basically that it will break a lot of shared links on Drive files. So if you're a user who has a share, which has never been used, then you'll probably have to add a resource key to get the share back. They did have solutions for all this, but they're trying to warn everybody that we're going to do this. If you do the update, you may have some issues at work. Basically, Google's advising you to evaluate your status with Google Drive so that you can avoid interruption and critical use when that update goes into place in September. It is optional, but you know how that works. A Pakistani threat actor, alleged Pakistani threat actor has been attacking government and energy operations in Asia and deploying a rat, which is used on compromised Windows systems. Most of the organizations were in India, Pakistan, India, they don't like each other. And Black Lotus Lab reported that most of the victims were a part of government and power utility verticals. So that whole group. The attacker basically used repurposed open source code and compromised domains that were located in the victim's country, which makes it look more legit. They also worked subtly by modifying registry keys, which would mean they weren't being logged. Of course, all this starts with a malicious URL, which downloads a zip with a shortcut to a PDF. It also downloads an HTML app, which, you know, is running while you're reading the document. The document was reported to be a user manual for managing some kind of appointment system for COVID-19. The application is a JavaScript called Cactus Torch, which is available on GitHub, that installs something called Reverse Rat. And if you don't know what Reverse Rat is, we've heard about it before. Reverse Rat, pretty typical thing. It allows, you know, basically it's a backdoor Trojan. You get in, you can run software, capture screenshots, manipulate the file system, exfiltrate user information and files, all that good stuff. And no, I have not been able to buy a 30 series GPU despite my efforts. I did find one that was $3,000, but it's about like my house search, which has been pretty futile, and it's just not happening. And finally, I know this is not a tech story, but you just can't resist these sometimes. The New York City Department of Health is really getting on the hashtag hot vax summer, with a new advisory, which includes that if you are planning to attend a sex party, you should definitely get vaccinated. I was like, okay, you think? If you aren't familiar with the New York City Health Department's summer newsletter, which you might want to check it out because they often have exciting advice like this. So last summer, they were saying how you should choose creative sexual positions which involve physical barriers with holes cut in them and such to avoid face-to-face contact. Okay. I mean, honestly, it's good advice, and you be you, and as long as everybody's of age and consenting, I don't care what you do. But to those of us here with a sophomoric sense of humor, it's still pretty fun and pretty funny. And that is the news wrap up for the week of 20 June 2021 in the declining time of plague. Vaccines are good, okay? Aaron will be filling in for me on Tuesday, so it should be fun. See you next week on the Security Weekly News.